I'm going to pass this around. These are some scenes from still images from the DVD, which you hold, and I guess many of you hold. Mm-hmm. And this is just as a visual memento, so you can kind of remember what this last thing is about. And if you have your own copy of DVD, you'll notice that it has two parts. The part they played, which is about 6 or 7 minutes, and try to encapsulate what is the gist of Lattice. And then there's a longer one that's 20 minutes or 22 minutes. It's kind of a documentary, like how did Lattice start, what does it consist of, what is a typical session like, and so forth. And it's a DVD-ROM, if they've copied it, like the original one, which has documents, I think Mac and PC, both, about letters, sample letters that they wrote to the deans to get money, sample budget, some agendas of typical sessions. So the things that you could adapt, you could take off the shelf, change the words, and you have a document. So it's a DVD-ROM. So that's what this side of the piece of paper is. The other side of the paper is called the brainstorming frame, and it's just a grid. And the intent of this session is to take your ideas and put them down somewhere so that when you get back and you have all your mail to catch up with and greeting your family and friends and so on, that when you kind of think back and say, oh yeah, I want to do something with that, you'll already have a plan. You don't have to just get it, go at it cold. So I guess not all of you were here, so what I'm going to do is use my presentation, and there are a couple of the slides which list some of these elements, these core central parts of Lattice, for example. And the way that I've constructed this is these are the parts that you want to have when you're building this collaborative, and I have to back up, I guess, and say, what is this collaborative? It started in 1995, and it's half teachers from the Mid-Michigan area from several grade levels, and it's half international students from Michigan State. I think mostly Michigan State. Maybe there's a few others who are not, or spouses of students as well. But and they're from different countries. You try to get a cross-section from all different parts of the world. And the idea is to have a sustained relationship with these people you meet for 4 hours once a month from 12:30 to 4:30. So it means teachers miss a little bit of school, and their districts have to be willing to come up with that money to cover that cost. And then the Lattice organization was able to lobby the NRCs, the Title VI centers at Michigan State, to provide a pool of money that would pay, compensate graduate students as an honorarium, really, $40 for the afternoon to compensate them for some of the time that they've given up. And it's a year-long school year commitment, so it's 8 sessions, and short of a death in the family or some horrendous accident or something, you really are expected to be there, because that's the whole value of Lattice, is a face-to-face interaction. And not only are you missing, but other people miss you, you know, your contribution. So it is a strong commitment for that period. And people who really get hooked on it and want to stay, I don't know if there's a policy, if they ever did decide that after so many years you have to vacate your seat so somebody else can get on. But that's the unspoken understanding, at least I understand. There are a few people who have gone away and come back. And certainly you can sign up for the email list, and some of you have done that, and you're welcome to. On the back of the pamphlet, kind of overview of Lattice, there is a contact for Cornea. She's the keeper of the email list. She sends out during the school year on a Monday and a Thursday, I think. Things that people contributed, things that she's received, things that she's found. Some of it's local, geographically local, and other things are national and international. But as a model, if you want to follow some of the elements of that email format or individual piece of content, you're always welcome to forward it and so on. It's easy to delete if you find it cumbersome, but anyway, that's available to you. That's a little bit about Lattice. But this is really what I wanted to use, or something similar, just to start to talk about your own circumstances. How can you envision this, or is it completely out of the realm of possibility? So maybe we can just go around and talk about our own circumstances. I've told you about mine. I'm just kind of frustrated, but I still am hopeful that something like this will happen for Southeast Michigan. There's so many natural synergies. Michigan State's 65 miles away. Eastern Michigan's 8 miles away. Training so many teachers at both those places. You know, you could do a Lattice just for pre-service teachers. You know, they could be your teacher component. Internationals could be this, you know, the same mix of a sustained relationship between pre-service teachers. You can even give it a course number, I suppose. So as long as you're doing a sustained, long-term, semi-structured exploration of each other's identities and culture and so on, it's very powerful, very deep knowledge, they call it. So let's just go around and talk about how this might work for you or what questions you have.
Just have a copy.
Yeah.
I work in New Haven, Connecticut with Max and Brian, and I can see that this might be really useful in some of the school partnerships that we've worked on, and particularly in the last couple of years, and in particular for the seventh grade level, because they focus themselves on cultures, and we've talked about having a way that we could bring those teachers together to discuss the new curriculum and how they're going to implement it. I see this as a good way to structure some of that. The other thing that I like to do personally, though, is involve international students. So, and I know that our Office of International Students and Scholars would be very interested in, doing that. So the question, though, for me is more, how do you recruit the teachers that come to this, because there are issues in our particular case of how many hours can be allotted to this kind of work and so forth. So how
from
do you
the
get
school administrator's point of view?
Well, yeah, but how do you yourself recruit the teachers to get them to come to your sessions?
Well, you've got relationships with a number of teachers in your area and driving distance area, probably from a number of functions, and then with your sister centers, too, if you kind of pool all those various things, you probably know some of your teachers are very outspoken and some of them are real doers, and they've been on some study tours maybe and so forth. Those would be natural people to talk to, and they will likely, word of mouth is very powerful as well. But you want to especially focus on middle school teachers.
I do.
Do you want to do that at exclusion of others? Because it really is, there's an interesting dynamic that happens when you have teachers at the different levels. They have different issues. But again, since the focus is, in this case, the focus is for the personal part, finding out what little you know and what you do know and so forth and challenging yourself. And then that attitude of respect and the way the person goes out of that room kind of indirectly affects what they do in the classroom. Actually, it might directly affect. Sometimes it invites a student along to their school or they take something they've learned and it becomes something that they use. But it's more the attitude that goes with that person. Mm-hmm. But in your case, you would adapt it especially to focus to this target group.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's my first, what other people think. I've been doing this for a few years, but as far as identifying teachers who would be keen on this, that would be my first inclination, is go to your lists of people who participate.
I think it fits a need, but maybe Max and Brian have other ideas on how it might be used.
Do you think students would be interested? I mean, it's not a given that students would, they pay a lot of money, they come here, they're doing classes, you want them to take 4 hours every month and sit around and talk and eat cookies and stuff? I mean, would you think students would buy it, or are they too serious? Or
they've really volunteered, actually, in some even heavier kind of projects than that. So it's not the international students it's concerned about. It's more the teachers and getting them to come. Because one of the issues that we face is that they're very strongly unionized, and they're very strict about how much time they'll spend, particularly those teachers in New Haven. And so that would be my concern in recruiting them.
We face the same issues in California. I'm sorry I came in late, but we have a similar program called Teachers as Scholars, where we have to get release time and substitutes. In LA, it's, and it's for three meetings. So it's $250 per day, so $750 per teacher times 20, and then the LA Unified School District says, well, why should we let you go here and not do math and science and literacy?
And so it would be almost better to do the whole thing off the books almost, just on your own time. We're giving you this enrichment. You're outside of the system.
No, but that never, so this is the obstacle, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And this is a challenge for me.
Unionized teachers.
Mm-hmm.
They come to your program, and they are clocking the time.
They are.
Uh-huh.
But not in this case. In this case, I think that the content of the content of the seminar, and the fact that it's in depth, and the fact that it somehow is connected to the framework, but not really, because it focuses on the higher skills of like critical thinking, multiple perspectives, and perhaps is a real carrot for them.
It's personal development. It's
they need to get out of the classroom and to have brain time and to communicate and to share and to be back in kind of the world of scholarship, because they were once scholars and maybe they lost it along the way. So what is the methodology? I can never go to the school district to the front door, because I will have to just mm-hmm. compromise mm-hmm. myself and compromise the ideal of this program. So again, it's the old guerrilla warfare. that if you can't go to the top, you maybe. And I find the teachers are the best spokespeople for. And if they hassle their vice principal day in, day out, that this is a good program, this is good for them, they'll be better teachers when they come back, even though it's not quantifiable, it's not measured to the test, that obviously the relationship between the enlightened teachers and producers and enlightened students, that's a powerful mechanism for the principals to release them. I've done this for like 4 years now, 3 seminars a year, and they're all full. And once one person from the school says, I got in, then they pressure, it's leverage. Well, how come he got in and she, and then how come this school? And then what also works for me really well is that I invite the principals. And I say, after like 1 or 2 seminars, I say, well, thank you so much. You yeah. can't believe how powerful, what great agents of change you are. And what you've done for your teachers. Hear the testimonials.
You have a host school, in this case, a host mm-hmm. school. Mm-hmm. Principal or vice principal was for those 8 sessions came.
Right. It's really critical to somehow also empower and recognize the administrator, because they're also under the gun because to release these teachers.
And another carrot is when you've got NRCs and you've got a group of teachers over a long term, that you can raise the possibility that you'll propose a GPA. Because I've got people who are already charged up, and so
it's really empowering.
And several of these people have gone on different ones, not all the same one at the same time, but
the summer program is going to bring in the teachers year in, year out, and in large numbers. But this is the prize, this is the cherry for my, mm-hmm. and it's the most difficult one, and it's the one that the International Institute wants to drop, just because of how difficult it is to get this in the time that I spend.
It's a big investment on a few people, is what it is.
Yeah. And my time, because I do the recruitment. I connect. I give the teachers the letters. I give them the wherewithal to connect. But it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's a deep knowledge. It's really
mm-hmm. I apologize for joining late, but do you in Michigan? Do you have CEUs?
Yeah, same.
And do the teachers receive CEUs?
No, in this instance, they don't. And I don't know if you could structure it in such a way so that it would meet the requirements. But when I went through that process about 2 months ago for a Japanese language conference and jumped through all the hoops that Michigan puts out, as far as who's speaking during what time slot, getting verification of attendance and all that kind of stuff, I don't know that they would, although there is a substantive speaker each time, as John Messer said, a 40-minute substantive guest, yeah. and then discussion to follow. In Michigan, it has to be 3 hours of FaceTime contact time before you're even eligible. If you have 2.5 or 2, it doesn't meet their minimum, so in this case, I don't know if it would work.
Can you not? We have the same issue. So we give them university extension units. Mm-hmm. So we don't give them professional development points, but somehow get through the back door,
uh-huh.
get this course kind of...
It's not the main appeal and attraction for the teachers. No, I mean, it would be a nice extra, but it wouldn't be the thing that tipped the balance.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking for other universities, in Louisiana, that wouldn't work. But maybe in Connecticut, who knows, mm-hmm. what kind of units do teachers need to earn, mm-hmm. what are their
uh-huh.
little
incentives.
They like those, yeah.
Yeah, they do like those. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't have CEUs in Louisiana, so it's a moot point for us.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you, too, about how you go about getting them interested, and it is going through the teachers and getting them, because we've had so many teachers recruit more teachers from their school each time that we do it, and that's been the most successful.
And it's the word of mouth, the reputation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anybody else have ideas of how it might take place, how this might take form in your own circumstances?
More question. Can you give us some examples of how this intensive personal development leads to anything? What does it lead to in the classroom?
Well, today, who is here today is Margaret Holschlag, and she taught fourth grade for a number of years. She's doing technology right now, but as a result of her long term, and she's been at it from the start, so she's not a typical example. Someone who's just a year in, a year out, so maybe it's an extreme case. But she's very comfortable talking about other parts of the world and bringing, she has contacts to the current Lattice people, to former Lattice people. It's easy for her to bring people in, easy to talk about issues. She sees it relevant when she's talking about X to bring in Y. So her whole frame through which she views things and organizes things has changed. And then the next question is, so what? And that's kind of trite, but I mean, people will ask that question. They'll say, why is that relevant? Why does it matter that you're comparative instead of just sticking to the script? And, I mean, there's a lot of, you've probably have a stock set of answers for that, but, you know, personal enrichment, the world looks better when you can see it out of two eyes instead of one. I mean, that's kind of a visual response to that. But
right, but it gives her the tools to, when she's looking at the standards and benchmarks, she needs to address and achieve in her classroom. She's not just going to think of, okay, I'm going to, you know, I've got this topic. Because by doing this, she also knows about a parallel situation in another part of the world.
Uh-huh.
And so she will, teachers will, what they're comfortable with, talk about what they're comfortable with, what they feel comfortable talking about. And so she's going to internationalize her classroom. It's like guerrilla warfare.
It's
right?
Incrementally, it's infusion.
Exactly,
yeah.
Infusion, just by using comparative example.
Right, and that's at the core of the curriculum. I mean, you can look at the standards and you can try to match up to 7th grade, 17.2C. But what we do is we deal with primary resources, critical perspectives, multiple, you know, it's the whole, and they cannot deny that this is really the essence of education.
And the flip side of that question is, somebody who has not done that, how are they different or how are they diminished somehow? And it's just, if somebody hasn't been exposed to these other possibilities, then they kind of foreclose those things. Mm-hmm. This is what they've done, this is all they do, and this is all they're going to do. And ignorance is bliss. They think that's fine, it works, they're satisfying the test requirements and so forth. Mm-hmm. So there's both ways of answering that question, I think.
I think the other thing is, too, that they're networking with teachers within these groups, and there's
exactly.
a lot of value to the information you get from other teachers versus those in your own school.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a ton of information that way.
Just sitting here, I mean, if I was just talking to one person, we'd have an interesting conversation, but hearing all the different viewpoints that don't occur to the two of us, you know, so it just the multiplier effect of having multiple voices involved
mm-hmm.
is there. And it becomes normal to talk about these issues that are kind of, well, you know, maybe they seem like esoteric questions like translation and things like that, or is it okay to read something in translation? Are you missing a critical dimension mm-hmm. of what you're doing? Those are kind of theoretical questions, mm-hmm. you might say, but to be able to talk to other people, and that's a normal and reasonable question, that's really empowering. Yeah.
The empowerment also, I think, comes from many the teachers that may have been, I think maybe 120 teachers who went to these programs. It's also the ability to make intellectual jumps. I mean, and it's so difficult to kind of teach or show teachers who may even have lost all contact with research to make intellectual jumps. In Middle Eastern history, it's important, so they don't simply think in linear ways, but they can see, you know, even in our summer programs, maybe a couple people can make those jumps, and those are the ones who can take it a step further. But when they make those intellectual jumps, you know, and they engage in conversation, discourse with scholars, then they feel kind of almost a transformative. I mean, I heard you saw it here today, that it's transformative, you know. But I think that you can't deny it. And once you have it, you just want more of it. You know?
Yeah, it's true.
Well, I think it's, I was high school teacher before this, and one of the biggest things about professional development that mattered was those things that got you excited. And when you're a teacher, the joy of being a teacher, if you really like it, is that when you get excited, you can share that.
Yeah.
So if someone turns on your light bulb, you have the joy of going and doing that for 30 people. And that's what we love about it. There's no, I mean, that's part of the thing that I miss sometimes, is that experience of knowing that you turn on the light bulb for somebody, even if it was only two kids in your class that got it, or whoever was felt the passion that you felt. If someone did that for you, and especially if you don't get that very often, and you're in the school, and all those teachers are very... There's really rigid guidelines for what they teach. They do have a lot of freedom of how they teach and how they approach it. There is a lot that you have choice over.
Mm-hmm.
So you can affect that choice of, like, the examples they use and, you know, the kind of, if they use international examples or comparative examples, even in U.S. history, they learn how to do that.
Right.
Teachers don't go where they're not comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Especially when you're in front of, you know, 40 high school students. You don't want to feel embarrassed or feel insecure. So you stick with what you know. And if you become more comfortable, you go out.
But it's one of the flexible elements of the curriculum, is that you, and if you look at the standards, at least in California, is that you can use other case studies. So, for example, if you teach imperialism, you know, the main issue, you know, you focus on India, right? But if you can bring Egypt in, then you can substitute it and, again, bring the dialectical relationship of history, you know. So the case study approach also is interesting. And you try to kind of break out of the box and show that, yeah, India, but how do you get to India? Well, it's not through the Suez Canal, you know. You know, the latter part of history. So I think the case study approach is also really important.
I like the idea. But let me plug it with that.
Yes, please.
It sounds interesting. I can see it's very intense. But it also sounds really labor-intensive on the part of the organizer. Explain, please, how these dozen teachers couldn't you take a dozen teachers plus another two dozen teachers almost as far in four or five well-run afternoon workshops on different topics with presenters that you did your best to guarantee that there was going to be lively discussion afterwards?
Well, whether
it's at least in terms of different perspectives.
Well, I know what you're saying. It's a different learning model. If we're going to present something to you, you're going to be the consumer, I'm the producer, you sit there, and then we can engage in a dialogue, but basically still, I'm the provider. You're coming to my party. Whereas this, come as you are. You know, the teacher doesn't have to prepare, there's no advanced reading. That might add more power if you had advanced reading.
No, we have advanced readings.
But in this case, it's not. Come as you are, here's the presenter, listen to what they have to say, see what it does to your mind, see how you can react to this at your table level and in a whole group. And so, and talk about what's happening in your school, your country, that raises issues, conversations going this way and this way. And so, and you go home and you feel all charged up, but there's no homework. You came, you got excited, you went home. Next month, you go get excited, come home. So it's really entirely personal. It stops there. It's just for you. You don't have anything to do with it. If you want to do something with it, great, but you don't have to. It's just then and there.
Yeah,
and so you are the author of what you're doing. You're going there as a workshop person. You are in charge of the content. So it's really a different thing. And the example that one of the presenters before this talked about, there's a slide, and it went over very quickly, but there's a story behind it. Courtney said she went to this third grade class, Wiltshire Elementary Early Learning Center, and there's five students. And this is a new thing they just started this past year to see where it would go. And what happens is that student goes there for the day, I think it's the better part of a day, once a month over the course of the year, and they work with the teacher to make some plans. It's not just show up and kind of tag along with the class, they actually do some things together. But that foreign student with those young kids becomes, it's been explained to me, becomes a friend. This is our friend from, in this case, Malaysia. And she tells about her family, kind of some show and tell things. She's done, showed us how she does things. We showed her some things as well. We've taught her some things. And she's not a category. She's a person. She has a name. We know her. You know, if I see her out in the community, I can say hi to her. And actually, that happened to somebody. They were out skating on campus, and some kids ran up to them and, you know, greeted them by their first name and things like that. So from that point forward, whenever they hear about, you know, Malaysia, they'll think of this person. So it's like Lattice on a small scale. It's personalizing things.
I'd also like to go back to that model, though, because that model is inherently, I have to say, patriarchal, imperialistic, and that is like you're taking a teacher who, and you're preaching to the teacher, and you're saying, you know, it's not always that way. I'm just saying that the base of that model is
top
the
down.
Traditional top-down.
And
these are teachers. They spend every single day in front of the classroom. They are the authority.
Mm.
And they're not very comfortable with having that flipped on them, because traditionally the relationship between the teacher and the administration is that same top-down. They are being... You know, they are being told, you do this, you know, you do that.
Stay in your box.
And by turning that model, because educators, yes, they're not content experts, but they actually probably have something to contribute. to you, to every single person that they interact with. You might not know it, you might not think that, but you have to find that in order to do that. And you will be more, your center will be more enriched by it. Any staff or a faculty that you have involved with them will be enriched by it. And in turn, the teacher will be enriched by it. And will also, will bring other teachers, will say, you know, this is, I am respected when I go there. It gets down to a basic level of respect.
Trust and respect.
Trust and respect.
It's mutually beneficial relationships, and that's yes. one of the things that outreach really should be based on.
Yes.
Yes. Especially when you're dealing with teachers.
Yes.
I, you know, before my grant's moving from Emory, which is this big research institution, to Georgia State, which is a state, you know, university, and Emory is pretty much hated in the community
yes.
because
it's a private university.
It's a private university. It's very wealthy. It's very, you know, status, and it's viewed that way. And when people do venture out into the community, it's this, well, Emory University, and we're here to, you know, and it's very much resented. I notice the difference I get when I hand out an Emory card or a Georgia State card.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea of mutually beneficial, we've done several models actually that way, and it always seems to, it's harder to convince some people, but it always seems to be the kind of thing where people are more interested,
right.
the effects are more long-lasting, and, you know, you've got that multiplier effect.
Mm-hmm.
When we were talking yesterday about best practices in your session, and one of the things that I thought of that I didn't bring up because we had so many things is this juxtaposition of the private university versus the state university. Those of us in private universities often are fighting this century or centuries, as in my case almost two, reputation of ivory tower, of elitism, of racism, and you know, it could be that, at least in our case in the Stone Center for Latin American Studies, we were the first of the university to be going out into the community. And now, community service is required of every single student who enters. And so, you know, a private university didn't have in its mission,
mm-hmm.
initially, you know, public service,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's starting to change, but you know, we are having to deal with legacies,
mm-hmm.
and these are legacies in some communities that go back, you know, I can imagine, I know, at Yale, it goes back a long time. I'm originally from Connecticut, you know, and in New Orleans, it's, you know, it's very difficult. It has been difficult in the past. So there's, you know, the other thing, and then you have the state universities, which are land-grant institutions that have it in their mission at their founding. And, you know, and they should be taking that seriously. You know, I would say they don't necessarily like Georgia State versus Emory, have to fight that, although they still have the same, you know, status
mm-hmm.
problems.
But at the school district, the power, the paradigm of power still remains.
Yes,
so regardless
absolutely.
Of where you come from, you can be a supercharge, you know, you can have two power paradigms working at one and
right.
the same time, and the job is complicated.
But one of the ways that I think that might you might get around that is that these administrators are under pressure to produce, perform,
mm-hmm.
to
measure
exactly, and so they've got all these committees going on, and I got sucked into one of them, internationalization of the curriculum. Right, DeKalb County has one of the most internationally diverse school populations, and they don't know what to do with it. So, you know, there's all these talking heads sitting in a room. If I go to the person in charge of special programs and I tell her Lattice,
mm-hmm.
she is going to jump up and down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is what she's been looking for. It's something she can get credit for. It's something we can put in the media.
Well, listen, here's something even further if you want to be an innovator on this beyond that level. Is what about Lattice at the school level? Why not a student
yes.
club, which is geared towards the non-native speakers and native speakers, provide them a structure, semi-structured, a little formal element than face-to-face, small group stuff, maybe more interactive than the teachers, but a little food,
mm-hmm.
and,
yeah.
you know,
mm-hmm.
you've got a long-term relationship. Suddenly you know that person's name, they're not just a foreign face. I mean, it would work, I'm sure.
And the NRC could facilitate the training of master teachers to be able to lead that kind of activity.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right. Or you might even go to areas where there is already some background, like, you know, schools that have international studies magnets, mm-hmm. or people that have international flag day, you know, global. I mean, there's all kinds of entry points. Mm-hmm.
That's something that I struggle with. This is going on a philosophical thing, but flag day or mm-hmm. this week is China and this week is mm-hmm. a theme type thing. Yeah. And it's good for what it's good for, but that's very limited. At least people can now identify what is this, but and there's a place for it, but I think it's a very restricted place. When you break up the world into nation states, it has a place. It's a familiar label. When they have the news, you get the nation, the event, the incident, and it's very brief. But
at least those are entry points. I mean,
it is. Yeah. That's what it is. It's an entry
that's
point.
All it is.
But then give people ways to get to the next step.
Oh, yeah, totally.
They need some clues.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's Flag Day is shallow in many ways,
right,
or
right.
Food Day. You know
yeah.
what I mean? But you know, I had a project on the international magnet and the Food Day. I turned it over to this project with National Geographic Society, and they would raise money. They would sell food to raise money to give the kids in Afghanistan.
So again, they personalized the problem.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Man. And they raised like $10,000, man, over a year. They you know, sport day. You know, we did okay, run, for, you know, just do it for the kids in Kabul. You know, and they raised them, and these were poor kids,
mm-hmm.
and they were more apt to identify with the struggle of the kids in Afghanistan in middle schools. They were 12, 13-year-olds, and they still had, before their hormones really kicked in, and they were still thinking about fairness and justice and fair play and all this. But here's this little project, this Food Day project, turned into like a $10,000 project, that, and then they sent it to the money to Afghanistan, and the Afghani kids sent something back in return.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just awesome.
Yeah.
One of the partnerships I'm thinking about here, and I don't know if you've got your school as well, this is the University of Wisconsin School of Education has partnerships with Madison School, the school for their professional development schools. So they've got master teachers in, like, they've got two high schools, two middle schools, and two elementaries, I think. They've got master teachers paired with student teachers, and they it's not just your normal student-teacher cooperating teacher relationship. They have ongoing professional development for both the teacher and the student-teacher, and they work together. It's kind of this much more coordinated, integrated program. I don't know exactly how it all works, but I just found out about it like in the beginning of this year, and I want to watch them. But with, you know, our centers have been thinking about that's a way that we can work with them, and that might be one partnership to
mm-hmm.
go through
mm-hmm.
that way.
I think any time you can piggyback on a pre-existing network or relationship, you know, that's a lot of your work is done.
Were you at the UT Austin?
My colleagues were,
yeah.
And that's, and you know, as you're talking about, I think here in Madison, for this to work, we actually have to do this together.
Mm-hmm.
And we're, you know, we're really not very, well, some of us are good at collaborating with each other, but as a whole, we're not very good. Our culture isn't set up to do that. And so some of us who really want to do more of that, you know, see the UT Austin one and go, yay, you know, that's what we want to do. But, you know, we have eight centers, and that almost makes it more difficult because that's eight personalities. Well, really, you know, 16 if you count there, you know, 24, you know, looking at all the outreach coordinators and all the associate directors and the directors, and they all have different philosophies about networking. And some say, no, we can't work together too much because we'll lose our grant, you know, or some say, yeah, we should work together more because it gets more points. And if you can't get everyone to agree on how, you know, because I think as outreach coordinators, especially, I'm not an area study specialist, I'm a teacher, and so I tend to look at things in a much bigger picture, and there's other people that have that perspective. It's hard for me to stay in my class. I'm much more thinking about doing things.
I'm not right, too. We've instituted something at U of M. We have a little handy acronym, BORAC, Outreach Exchange, Coordinators Exchange or something, but they actually gave us on the shared server of our own folder, so we can put things that we want to give what the other people use, the other outreach people. So, you know, if you developed a flyer or a poster or a mailing list, whatever you wanted, kind of pour your information, then we can go, you know, get to it. And we have meetings. It used to be every other week, but now it's kind of got fallen apart. It's like every month.
Mm-hmm.
And we only get half the people showing up unless there's a big event. But so there is, we've created some kind of a institution that all the
right.
people can.
We're trying, but it's just we're fighting uphill. It's going to take a long time to change that. I think the first, you know, if I can get another outreach coordinator or two who thinks this is a great idea, then we can recruit all the other outreach coordinators, and then once we all think it's a good idea, then we can go to the assistant director and director's meetings that they have, and then we have to, like, convince them that it's a good idea because they have to spend money on it, and then we can start looking at
right.
the outside.
Yeah.
But nothing speaks like success.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, once
right.
once you hit it right, then it's just
Well, the remodeling medicine that is similar to this, it's called the Arista Scholars Program. It's funded by a private foundation, but they invite teachers to write grants every year for innovative projects in education. And if your grant is funded, then you might be invited to join a district think tank called the Arista Scholars. And I happen to be involved in that right now, but they the grant pays for two days away in the fall. They have a retreat with teachers. I don't know how many there's, maybe 20 scholars right now, and so pays for that. And then we have, I think, six meetings during the year after school, and the teachers just give their time to come to us because it's, you know, speakers are, the theme this year is educational policy, which is very dry. But,
so it's an intellectual thing, getting people.
Yeah, but I could see that because Madison is such an international community, and we have teachers who are definitely interested in international education, but there's no
central place for them
to come. This would be, I've been working on a project in my high school with South Africa, and just watching that grow has been wonderful and rewarding. But I'm a social worker, and actually so many grant opportunities come across my desk that I could see writing for funding for something like this, and it would be completely, you know, teacher at the very minimum, teacher subtitle. And then if you can offer some type of
an honorarium or something.
Credit or whatever, even more so. But I think there would be great interest in.
Yeah.
And these grants are through the Madison School District?
Some of them are. Some of them are Department of Transportation.
It's a scholar program. It's
private. It's private. Sarbanibom Foundation.
Oh, okay.
So again, the elements are already there. Uh-huh. It's just connecting the dots, so to speak.
Right. And what are some of the pitfalls of that you've seen over the years?
It's just the classic pitfalls of any outreach thing, of dropping the ball. There's all these pieces that have to be juggled, right?
But anything particular that is specific to this? Or is it the usual organizational initiatives?
Well, I only had a narrow window into the planning process because that's kind of the behind-the-scenes part, deciding who's going to speak and what they're going to talk about and the scope of what you want them to talk about and what you're going to do with that to follow on. And so, but like I say, there's this kind of culture that develops of mutual respect and trust and things like that. So when things get too hot as far as discussions, controversy and stuff, people know enough to back down or to hold their tongue or whatever. So things have never gotten to shouting or tears or angry. But, I mean, I was there during 9/11. Yeah, I started in the beginning of 2001. And when that came up, you know, it was 800-pound gorilla. How can you not talk about it? So that dominated two or three different sessions. And we had students from the Middle East, and they had a perspective that was very different from ours. And students from Europe, they had a different perspective. Again, we had students from Africa, from Asia. And to see this event, it's not just an American event. It affects everybody. And to hear that from people's, you know, own mouth, and to people who read the news in other languages, so international students go to the home pages or the newspaper section of the library and read these things from their perspective. Again, it's a different angle on it. But I remember those sessions, the conversations, started to get into some really emotional territory, and it wasn't criticism or taking things personal. It wasn't dangerous in that way, but it was people had strong opinions about things. But it never got out of control, again, because you have that understanding that we're in this for the long haul, and you know we've had a lot. You've taught me a lot. I've taught you a lot. You know, so pitfalls. I can't think logistically as far as the system, the money, the time, the scheduling, all that stuff. That's not a big problem. And the topics, that's not a big problem.
Do you ask the topics are chosen by the teachers? How does that work out?
I think there is of course you can email at any time. You know people well enough. On the planning team, you just call them up or email and say, I'd like to know more about this, or what do you guys think about that? So the communication is very open. But it's the planning team mainly that comes, that proposes things and talks things out And since it is representative, there's members from different grade levels and there's members from different components who make this collaboration up. They all have their angle on it and they say, I think that's a good idea, or I can think where that will go. And others will say, well, that I don't like the way that's going. So, yeah, pitfalls, I mean, that's a good question, but I can't give you any immediate answer. So I hope that you would all have your task list. You know who you're going to call up on Monday morning, but it's like people are...
Well, I have to do this. I have to do this.